all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or by going to veteransradio.net, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to veteransradio.net. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today, Matt Amadon. He is with the Bush Institute. We've had him on before. Matt, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Jim, thanks so much for having me, and thanks again to all your listeners. I know Veterans Radio has been doing great work for many years, and just honored to spend the time with everybody.
No, we appreciate you making the little time. Yeah, we're in our 20th year, so we've been able to hopefully get a lot of good information out to our veterans. And this is kind of an interesting thing that the Bush Institute is doing at the beginning of the year and making some recommendations to both federal government and state governments. But before we get to the specific recommendations, Matt, why don't you explain what the Bush Institute is?
Oh, no, honored to do so. Thanks so much. Really, the Bush Institute in Dallas, Texas, carries on the proud work that was done during the Bush administration. All of the things that were really important to President Mrs. Bush continue at the Bush Institute right there on the SMU campus in Dallas. And I'll just share with you, it really, you know, focuses on four pillars that we're so incredibly proud of, and that is freedom, opportunity, compassion, and accountability. We focus on educational achievements, economic growth, global health, AIDS relief in Africa. And of course, this is something that is very near and dear to both President and Mrs. Bush, as those who've served our nation, worn the cloth, and raised their right hands and swore that solemn oath for them and their families. What can we do for them while in service, and of course after they transition back into the civilian world? So it's been a wonderful 10 years for me at the Bush Institute, and we're really proud of the work we get to do there.
And we would point out that we'd be remiss if we didn't point out that Matt Amadon is a colonel in the United States Marine Corps Reserves. We were trying to get this scheduled, but he was out on some maneuvers a week ago, so we're glad.
Well, and I appreciate that, and again, a shout-out to all your listeners who've served, and most importantly, their families who served alongside them. I think, Jim, and you for Carol Ann, and everybody knows it's the family who joins, serves, deploys, and transitions together. I'll just let your listeners know I am a reservist, having proudly been in the Marine Corps Reserve since 2006, and I just clicked over 30 years of service, which just means I'm the old guy in the room.
That's right.
I'm proud to be there.
They look at you and say, he's got gray hair. What's that about?
Yeah, so, what is that old guy doing here?
Well, we're here to talk about the beginning of the year, some policy recommendations that the Bush Institute is putting out so that our political leaders and thought leaders in Washington and in state houses can maybe think about these issues and how they can improve the lives of veterans and veteran families. Why don't we start with the federal recommendations? There's four of them, and why don't you go ahead and take those, Matt?
No, I appreciate that. And, you know, the timing of these recommendations, as you so well describe, is to meet a new presidential administration, you know, when the elections happen. And the inauguration happened. So we did so a couple of years ago, of course, with the incoming Biden administration. And we also do so in the midterms, you know, in congressional cycles, and also focus most recently, a new focus for us, as you described, is at the state level. I mean, you know, the 10th Amendment matters and state power matters, and a lot of the real effective and enduring work can be accomplished by state governors. And I know we'll get to that, but to your point, I think before we dive into federal and or state, you know, we do our work on behalf of President and Mrs. Bush for three reasons, supporting veterans and military families. And it's material to our recommendations and to the ongoing work is that morally and socially, as we all know, it's just the right thing to do. And we should never waver from that. Secondly, it is an issue of national security and the sustainment of the all-volunteer force. And then finally, we firmly believe that this is an issue of global competitiveness and civic leadership. And for the right transition and the right follow-on trajectories, our veterans and their families will come home and lead in our businesses and in our communities, as we should most definitely want them to do. I don't think there's ever a reason, time, or circumstance where we wouldn't want leadership in our communities and businesses. And before I dive in, I'll just point to, as you and I have previously talked about, you know, the departure from Afghanistan. There's a lot of debate there. And again, we're not here to debate that. The point is that we're starting to observe that perhaps philanthropic winds are shifting elsewhere outside of the veteran and military family community. And I'm not suggesting that's bad. I mean, those are natural sort of changes in where focus happens. We're just suggesting that we should always stay focused on outcomes for veterans and military families, because regardless of time and circumstance, about, as you know, 200,000 will transition into the civilian world. So my long-winded lead, Jim, to the recommendations are, this is where we have to acknowledge that no one entity can do it alone. And by that, I mean federal and state government, philanthropic endeavors, nonprofit endeavors, private sector, and community sector. And therefore, our first recommendation to the administration, and it should be led by, you know, West Wing, East Wing, joining forces, big thumbs up to their work, is we need to really just kind of all get on that same big blue arrow. Is what does a national veterans strategy look like? Who should be doing what work, where and when? Where should we focus in limited resources? And we're never unconstrained by resources. And so how can each one of those sectors I described best contribute to the outcomes for vets and military families, acknowledging the three pillars I previously mentioned? So that's the first one, Jim, and I think it really is important. There's examples out there to emulate, one done by our friends at Syracuse, the Institute of Veterans and Military Families, good friends up there in Syracuse, wrote one a number of years ago. Across the pond, our friends in the UK have also written one, although their system of support is quite different. I acknowledge that. But, you know, you can get after it and it really can advance outcomes, acknowledging that you can't focus on everything. So we submit that a national veterans strategy should focus on advancing economic trajectories or the next career, the educational pathways to get there, and optimizing health and well-being. So that's the first pillar. And if you want me to dive into the rest, we can do so.
Well, I want to stop there for a minute because you sort of say, you mean we don't have a national veteran strategy? No, we don't. Just because we think the VA is in charge, right? Well, that's not the strategy. And that's, I think, what you're trying to point out at the Bush Institute is, hey, it's much broader than giving a whole bunch of money to the VA to do what they do, isn't it?
We've had a really, honestly, a 10-year wonderful relationship with the VA. Our one-of-a-kind Veteran Wellness Alliance and our check-in tool, which for anybody out there facing mental health or brain health issues for them and their families, just go to veterancheckin.org and get free and anonymous health care in all 50 states, Puerto Rico, and D.C. In doing so, we couldn't do that without the VA. So you're entirely right. But as you relate the hard work to those three pillars of the moral and social, the national security issue, and global competitiveness, your point is well taken, and the VA is crucial and instrumental to that end, but it is not complete, and it requires everybody.
Yeah, and there are so many people who do want, and this is one of the things we've always bumped into, there are so many people who do want to help veterans that all too often they overlap or they are in circles where there's a gap and somebody falls through. So really a national strategy that really helped line up philanthropic, public, private partnerships, VSOs, the VA, Pentagon, DOD, the whole thing would really
get a role to play. Yep. And a strategy, again, you know, a strategy, again, is not just a poster on a wall. A strategy is concrete, fundamental steps sectors can take to focus, you know, constrained resources. And that's what strategy is all about. It's about prioritization of resources. And we believe those three lanes of effort, which are employment, education, and health and well-being, are something where all stakeholder sectors should focus on that. And many do. I'm not suggesting they don't. I'm just saying let's publicly state that and make very public our willingness to focus on those, because those appear to be the three fundamental pillars that really impact success in transition, success in follow-on follow-on trajectories, or lack thereof.
So that's a, you know, that's a big picture item. I think a lot of people would say, "Yep, we don't have one. That ought to be one." So what's the second recommendation here on the federal side, if you will?
Well, and that's the Department of Defense. Many, many years ago, used to have something called the Chairman's Office of Reintegration, they stopped doing business, I think, in 2014, 2015. I don't remember the exact number, but again, when you have this whole of nation effort, to your point, is well intended. People want to help, and they just don't want to hand out. They want to help people with a hand up, you know, a job, and really do some fundamental work. It's our belief that perhaps DOD, and specifically the chairman of the Joint Chiefs Office, could make a little more public, functional, and fundamental their role in the transition life cycle. The reason why that's important now, I think, and I believe you and I previously talked about the recruiting goal and some of the threats. You know,
we did,
one of the services is, they're just, it's a challenging environment to attract talent to your organization. And, you know, everybody's trying hard. The recruiters are doing just this amazing work. And certainly COVID had its impact. But, you know, there's other issues at play. It's a declining propensity to serve amongst some of our younger folks. And again, I'm not here to, you know, neither you or I nor any of your listeners are sort of the woe is me audience. We're like, what can we do about it? And we just feel that a better intersection between DOD and the veteran population could be afforded by the return of the Chairman's Office of Reintegration. That would make very public, functional, and fundamental the acknowledgement, the role that DOD, specifically the Chairman's Office, plays in the transition life cycle. What that did for all of the stakeholders you mentioned is it was a one-stop shop for people to go talk about issues in transition. And now, you know, necessarily folks have to go to each one of the services who do their some things, you know, distinctly and individually. Then you have to acknowledge that there's the Undersecretary's Office for PNR and Readiness, and wonderful people, wonderful organizations. But to just combine that transition effort, and in doing so, you can then really leverage, I believe, the veteran community and you know, choose your number, choose your data, choose your survey. But most of them do indicate that those of us who have served are immensely proud of what we did, you know, greater than 80%. And many would then recommend it to a close family member or somebody in their, you know, circle of connections. And so there, to me, is an incredible opportunity to tie those two things together. Wonderful organizations out there. There's many out there, VFW, Legion, all those wonderful, wonderful organizations, but including ones like Team Rubicon, Team Red, White, and Blue, The Mission Continues, Student Veterans of America, who else? The Elizabeth Dole Foundation, the Travis Mannion Foundation, where veterans are leading functionally in our communities and in our towns and you know, to best integrate those folks and their follow-on service to this nation with, you know, fostering a little more propensity to serve in our nation's youth and our eligible populations.
And
it'd be an exciting thing to do.
It would be. And these two recommendations really focus on things DOD should do. It should leverage that veteran and military family, those communities, the traditional and the non-traditional, right? Team Red,
exactly.
White, and Blue, Rubicon. Team Rubicon, yep. All sort of those are a little bit less traditional, maybe, but they ought to be leveraged. And also this.
You know, and all of them. Yeah, all of them. Absolutely.
And this idea that DOD should invest further in the transition assistance program, because one thing leads to the other, right? If I'm gonna get an all volunteer force and I'm gonna recruit more folks where I'm having trouble, I damn well better be showing folks that we help them in transition, and they're in a good place, and they'd make that kind of recommendation to their sons and their daughters and their nieces and their nephews that service is worthwhile.
I mean, well said. I couldn't say it any better, and that's absolutely right. And so, you know, those folks are in towns and communities where you may have challenges in reaching a recruitable population. And to your point, then, the sort of the follow-on logical sequence is, in order to do that, how can we better support those who are transitioning? And again, I'm not here to cast dispersions on the TAP program. DOD, VA, and the Department of Labor have made wonderful investments in TAP over the years. And certainly for many, it's better than what it was years ago. And I would argue it continues to get better every year. However, you know, transition TAP is not a monolithic thing. It's as good as the station you're transitioning out of. And you know, there's variance in quality. And of course there is. There can never not be. But within that, the vast majority likely benefit from the, you know, the playbook that is TAP today. But data show, and I think if people can point to some of our, you know, there's our friends up at Penn State at the Clearinghouse for Military Family Readiness at Penn State. Good friend of ours, Danny Perkins, and his team have run some data sets and capture that indicate that success in transition and follow-on success after transition is more compromised and more at risk for, and I'm going to totally generalize here, so please forgive this, but it's fairly accurate for our younger enlisted female communities of color have greater challenges, generally speaking, than their colleagues in really capturing those post-service outcomes. And when you acknowledge that, you know, most of our recruiting success comes from our southern states, they call it America's Smile, and it is becoming increasingly a family business. Well, let's double down a little more elegant investment in those who may need things like one-on-one counseling, you know, customized counseling, customized e-learning, that may just be an investment of a specific and additional resource that for those who may have that now data-informed need signal. And to your point, that would enable us to really broaden the aperture for those who are proud of their service, need to be resourced in a better and more elegant way for their follow-on service trajectories.
Particularly when, with the recruiting struggles, there's more and more acknowledgement that we need to be recruiting more women into the military. That's a area where some expansion can occur, but you sure better be helping them on the transition out as well. Your fourth federal recommendation from the Bush Institute was interesting to me, because I want you to elaborate on how the VA and Social Security could focus on advancing data collaboration. Yeah. That's probably one that would not come to mind for a lot of folks. So I think it's worth explaining.
Yeah, no, my good friend, Captain Dan Goldenberg, U.S. Navy retired, who runs the Call of Duty Endowment out on the West Coast. We've been talking about this for years, and they've been really carrying the water here, and we're honored to help them in that regard. But to your point, nobody here is going to argue that data collaboration is easy. I'm, you know, Jim, I think you're a lawyer. The lawyers always win, right?
Well, I don't know about that, but she'll argue about it.
Yeah, well, the point is, and it comes from, I think, a really interesting place. And in order to generate, and I'll do the fast version, in order to generate, you know, your weekly unemployment data, the government puts out sort of a weekly survey that asks you generally one question, which is, did you work for money last week? And in doing so, you could have mowed your neighbor's lawn, you could have been on military reserve duty or otherwise, and not really part of the employment structure of our country, you know, in the job market, doing what you would expect or we would expect you to do. And it's also aggregated almost up to the state level. And so that's kind of the description of the problem. If you and I want to have a more tailored transition experience for those in need, well, we would also want to know, where do they go after service? And if we could have an elegant combination of what's known as the VA VADER database And then some elegant anonymized, you know, nothing that would compromise individual safety, security, or information. But if you could somehow integrate that with the Social Security payroll information, you could then get earnings, lack thereof of earnings, almost at the zip code level. And think about the benefit of that, where then we could take job resources, the Department of Labor, American Job Centers, and say, let's target more resources in these communities, in these places where it clearly shows that somebody who likely is a veteran is not earning what we think they should earn, you know, based on where they are, in what community, and in what zip code. So it's a pretty exciting thing to think about. However, I certainly acknowledge how hard it could be. But that's one where we say, and I think, Jim, to your point, it's not necessarily, you know, let's come up with a great idea of better data collaboration. Well, that's easy to say, but this one is actually a functional example of data collaboration that could happen and really result in the information necessary to target resources to those in need. And if you think about return on invested dollar, my goodness, what better way to do it than with that?
Well, it really is an interesting thing, because you have all this information being collected, but unless it's done as accurately as possible and as timely as possible, it just sort of goes on the shelf. And really what we're saying here in this recommendation, I think, is, hey, you guys have the opportunity, because you are collecting the data, it is can be done accurately if matched up right, and it can be timely, and then we can use it, veteran resources can use it to make sure we're helping the veterans at the time and the place that they need to be. It's an interesting idea.
On a weekly basis, you could do that almost. And you could also, you know, the smart people could come up with almost a dashboard to say, in these parts of our country, we're starting to see, you know, differentiated unemployment. It may, at the state level, it may be 4.5%, which is pretty good. But in these, you know, 12 counties, it's 12%. Or, you know, if you're going to get super sophisticated about it, in these 12 counties, we can certainly see indicators that you know, certain folks are underemployed and not earning as much as we think they should. So not only but underemployment, and both are very, of course, impactful on a family's financial stability.
Oh, absolutely. That underemployment is also a very big problem.
And yeah,
again,
hard to define.
And particularly for certain classes of veterans, and they may well be those that you mentioned earlier on, more difficult transitions like women and underrepresented minorities.
Right.
Very interesting federal recommendations that can get some traction. Let's turn to the state recommendations, which I thought was a nice add here, because there are a lot of more progressive, nimble, active state houses that can make changes much quicker than they do in DC. So these recommendations are also very important.
I think you're hitting on the ultimate question of where the rubber meets the road. And, you know, for 10 years, we certainly have focused our megaphone, at the federal level, but within the last 2 to 3 years, you can't ever de-link federal intent with state delivery. And, you know, states like, and I'm just going to choose a couple states, but there's so many out there doing just wonderful work that really needs to be highlighted. And, you know, Texas, Arkansas, North Carolina, New Jersey, just all really getting after it and trying to advance outcomes. I think it's important just to recognize that states have ready levers they can pull to do things that remove barriers to economic opportunity. I point back to, it was a number of years ago, Utah passed something very interesting. This is, Jim, that kind of sort of triggered our interest at the state level. But a number of years ago, Utah passed what's known as Senate Bill 227, I believe it was called. And it basically allowed for, out of the passage of the legislation, for universal reciprocity for, I believe it was military spouses who had nursing degrees. So that if a military family moved to Utah, that military spouse was immediately employable in the state of Utah in the healthcare industry without having to pass. And some states do require you to pass, you know, the state licensing boards,
right,
which that comes with a cost and a time. And so if you really think about that and now expand it, it's almost the infinite opportunity across any profession that's licensed, you know, psychiatry, healthcare, you name it, teachers in some ways. If you could think about as a state, do you have barriers that inhibit or enhance the economic mobility of veterans who want to move to your state? And I think that's really, if you're going to take our four recommendations and sort of boil them together, that's really the assessment that governors should lead along with their key, you know, state-based VA directors, of course, have to be there. But again, acknowledging that no one entity can do it alone, almost like a task force with some of your educational leaders, led by the governor, some key legislators, certainly your state-based VA, but could come together and say, you know, hey, listen, we of course want veterans and military families in our communities because they lead. And in doing so, do we have state structures that enhance or inhibit the ability to do so?
Yeah, this is a good example of where the states can be more nimble. They can say, hey, we can remove these barriers. We can give reciprocity. We can give credit for that military experience so that can come in and get to work, whether it's a EMT or a nurse or a, you know, you've been driving trucks for the Army. You ought to be able to drive them on our roads. All of those kinds of things, there are all kinds of impediments to it. And if you're a state that is looking to expand your population, I would argue you should remove these kind of barriers and let the men and women who have been serving and gained those skills attract them to your state to apply their skills.
Well, you know, and it just starts with what is our current structure? And so many states are doing great work to get after that. But to your point, it starts with I think, you know, if you're going to live life in series, it certainly starts with the governor leading a focus on their current regulatory structure, what it looks like, what are the barriers, and then asking the question, you know, how have those barriers then inhibited, to your point, attracting talent to our state? Everybody wants talent in their state. Now, you can't imagine any state that doesn't want that. But then that's where state educational leaders could really think about how, alongside those regulatory barriers, they can, to your point about EMT1s and EMT2s, is how can they perhaps adjust some of their curricula inside a course of education to accelerate pathways to employment? And I'll point to our friends at Texas Tech up in Lubbock. They have a wonderful curricula for those who want to pursue nursing professions and who are previously medically trained in the military. They have an accelerated pathway to employment at Texas Tech. And there's many others in the country, I should say. I just choose them because I know them best. But I think that's a shining example of, you know, a large, wonderful educational institution working alongside and within a state structure to attract talent and accelerate their ability to get into the workforce. And you mentioned EMTs, Jim, and that, I mean, there is a national shortage. If you look at some of our critical industries, if I'm going to choose two today, and I'm not suggesting the others aren't important, but what about healthcare and teachers? There's almost, I think it's, I don't remember the number, but it's north of 30,000. We're 30,000 teachers short in this country in some really at-risk states. So how about you accelerate pathways into teaching too? And there's some legislative efforts ongoing. One that I know most closely is in New Jersey, but they exist elsewhere. So to your point, how can we accelerate pathways into critical industries in each state as well? And that certainly should be a focus of effort.
So we're talking to Matt Amidon from the Bush Institute. Matt, if folks are intrigued and they want to pass these recommendations along to their federal or state elected officials, where can they find more about these particular recommendations?
Oh, we would love to have folks check out our website at bushcenter.org/publications. You know, I honestly, Jim, look me up on LinkedIn as well. I am happy to share them there. It's just Matthew Amidon. But in doing so, you can not only see our veteran and military family policy recommendations, but of course, our other recommendations as well across our programs. And we're very proud of those. We have some immigration policy recommendations, economic growth policy recommendations, educational reform policy recommendations. And so, yeah, please check us out at bushcenter.org and spread them far and wide because, again, you know, we have to continue this megaphone and this drumbeat of support and to our, you know, the beginning of our conversation, regardless of time, circumstance, or context, it would just be really shocking to me if this nation didn't want to leverage the immense talent transitioning out of DoD every year, which again is in the neighborhood of, you know, what is it, plus or minus about 200,000 folks every year. So let's get after it and make sure that they have the follow-on experience they so richly deserve and our nation so richly needs.
Absolutely. Again, Colonel Matt Amidon, Director of Veterans and Military Families at the Bush Institute, we appreciate you taking some time today to talk to Veterans Radio listeners about these kinds of national and state recommendations.
Honored to take the time with you and your listeners, Jim. Thanks so much, and look forward to the next opportunity.
You got it, Matt. Thank you.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We again want to thank our national sponsors, the National Veterans Business Development Council, NVBDC.org, VA Ann Arbor Health Care System, the Vietnam Veterans of America Charles S. Kettles Chapter, Ann Arbor, Michigan, VFW Graf O'Hara Post 423 in Ann Arbor, and the American Legion Prescorn Post 46, also in Ann Arbor. We appreciate all your support. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on the sponsor level, and continue to support keeping Veterans Radio on the air. And until next time, you are dismissed.